Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Look at my butt. Now look at my front butt. Wada, 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 wada.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood receiver pressure increases.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Well, Magneto's right. There's a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
Welcome to Cult Side Radio. Usual, I told you about 4 or 5 weeks ago that I promised that I would never work with Carl Kafer again, and I will keep my word. Isn't that right, Mr. Roberts? John Roberts is my co-host today. Isn't that right, Mr. Roberts?
I'm not Mr. Roberts, okay? If anything, I'm
not. Yes, you are. I keep my word. Okay. Don't let a Southerner break his word.
Okay, I'm Robert's Blossom and, then, okay?
Yeah. And my guest today, well, I looked up his IMDb and stuff like that, and they all kept saying, this man is best known for Diamonds Are Forever. And I said to myself, they're not from the South when they wrote that, but we'll get into that later. He have actor... one of the best character actors in the 70s, and he holds acting classes now. And we're honored to have him on here, and it's Mr. Bruce Glover. Say hello, Bruce.
Hi. And I'm still acting. It's not just the 70s. It's the 80s and 90s and the 2000s. I just finished a film with my son, Crispin. We worked on the project. Did it very quickly. It only took 5.5 years, so... we're still editing, and the film will hopefully be out in a year. But, I'm also a writer and a painter, and I've done a lot of other films since the 70s. I've done actually 100 films, but before that I did 100 plays, more plays than most people have even read the title of. I worked on Broadway, off-Broadway. I did repertory theater. I did classical theater. And then television was wiping out theater, and I was a New York actor for 12 years, and I had to move out to L.A., Hollywood, to start doing films and making a living and living in West L.A., and so I'm always working on projects. I don't look my age. I'm strangely still healthy. I played soccer for 30 years. I had two soccer teams. I gave one of them away, and we brought both teams into a league, and my team didn't lose a game for 3 years. So I'm still athletic and strong, and working on an art book right now. I do paintings. I do a lot of different styles of paintings. And the film with Crispin, my boy, who is now touring, and he probably will be in Tennessee. He might be there.
Yeah, Chattanooga film the last week.
Right. Well, he's going on to Chattanooga. Eventually.
Was last week.
Yeah. Well, he's touring right now, and we have a script. He wrote a script. I wrote on it. He plays four characters. I play four characters. Three of my characters are the older version of three of his, because he looks a lot like me, and I look a lot like him, and it works pretty well. I do three different accents. One is Irish, and another one is kind of a Chicago kind of tough guy kind of way of talking like that. And then there's one that's fairly normal. Yeah, I've been in the business a long time, and will continue doing things around it. I've got film scripts that I've written, and I'm not sure which direction I'm going to be going in more. But right now I have to work on my art book, paintings and that kind of thing. But eventually the film will come out. It's right now called an untitled Crispin Hellion Glover film. And so the real title will come out when finally the film is ready to be released. So, question.
Even if you kept it as that title, it still sounds cool to me, doesn't it, you, Carl? An untitled Crispin Hellion Glover film.
Well, tell Crispin that if you can get him on the phone.
Yeah.
I kind of like
well,
that
you
title.
You say, Carl, that would be like a cool title for a movie, just untitled.
I think
by Crispin Hellion Glover. Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I'm going to tell Crispin that.
Cool. Just tell him to call it untitled. That works for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did a lot of films in Tennessee. I did the three Walking Tall films in Tennessee.
Yeah.
Okay, Steven, take it. I don't know if you know this.
I live about 40 minutes from the town where Buford really comes from. They still have a festival for him every year.
Yeah, well, Buford and I became strong friends during the filming, and at one point they decided to do a sequel, and Buford was going to play himself. So I did Buford's screen test with him, and the first film was the real film. I mean, that was the one that really portrayed something of what Buford was about, which was about, you know, right and law and family and protecting family and protecting people and going after the bad guys. But they lost that quality in the second film, because Buford and I did his screen test. They set up a whole set with a whole crew, and we had like three sets. I was going to play my deputy to Buford, and also did another character, which was a criminal that he taught. And so when Buford arrived, and one of the things that they don't understand about Buford was a man of great fun. He and I had a lot of fun together. He had a great sense of humor, playfulness. And he also had a sense of honor. And he honored women, and he honored family. He was all about family. They overemphasized the club too much. It's like, no, Buford wasn't about the club. The club was something that was used in one situation. The people, you know, the second film, when Buford and I saw again on the movie set, he came in. He was scared to death about acting, and he said to me, "I'm scared to death." And I said, "Well, that's a good place to start, Buford." And then the director that they had assigned to do the screen test walked onto the set, and he was one of those old-time, you know, directors who doesn't know anything more than roll 'em and cut, and that's printed, and that's about all he could say. So he said, "All right, we should read through the scene." So Buford and I sat and read through the three, I guess it was three scenes. I think it was four. Anyway, and Buford was terrible. And the director stood there wobbling on one foot and the other foot and looking at us and didn't know what to say and looked confused, looked up at the lights above, looked over to the right, to the left, looked at us and kind of then suddenly spun on one foot, running off the set going, "Let me know when it's lighted." And Buford said to me, "I was terrible, wasn't I?" I said, "Yeah, you were." He said, "Well, what am I going to do?" I said, "Listen, Buford." And in a sense, I gave Buford a really quick acting lesson. And people, I still teach, and I teach because it allows me to keep learning. Any teacher that knows it all is a lousy teacher. I'm still learning.
Nice.
After 60
Amen,
years.
Amen, right, Carl?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's Earl.
And
you know,
he didn't get to film one scene on the movie before he had the crash, did he?
Who? Buford did a screen test. Yeah, Buford did a screen test. And so Buford said, "I'm terrible." And I said, he said, "What am I going to do?" And I said, "Buford." And in a sense, just like an acting lesson, I said, "Buford, when you were in your car and patrolling and you'd see a car and you had a wonder about them, you'd start following them and you'd look at them and watch how they were driving and then you'd call in the license plate number and wait for a call back on what they saw with that number. And then when you turned on your lights and told them to stop, that you would watch how they responded. Then when you parked your car, you'd park it out a couple, 3 feet so that you could walk up behind the car without being hit by oncoming traffic. And as you approached the back of the car, you'd look to see if there was anyone in the back seat. And then you'd look to see if there was anyone in the passenger seat. And then you'd look over the shoulder, kind of behind the driver, and look to see. And then you would... when you gesture him out, you would make sure he didn't have anything in his hands. It was dangerous, and you'd look at the eye, and you'd watch how he was responding to what you were saying, and then you'd listen to him when he was talking to you to see if he was drunk or whatever, and Buford suddenly said, "Yeah, I do all those things." I said, "Well, Buford, that's how you act." He went, "Oh, okay," and he was terrific. He was terrific all the way through. And at the end of the evening, the day of working was daytime, and Buford just had, I was already out of uniform, and my wife had taken my son Crispin up to a Boy Scout camp, and I was going to go meet him there. And Buford was always about family, and I said to Buford, He was just doing a close-up of him, and he didn't really need me. And I said, "Buford, do you need me here?" And he said, "No, you go ahead, Bruce," because I told him my boy was up there. And again, Buford was about family and respect for family and respect for women. And he was a real guy and a real person. He wasn't this weirdo with a club running around. I said, "Well, great, Buford, I'll see you in Tennessee." And he was up on his truck bed, and I reached up and goosed him, and he yelled at me, "I'll get you in Tennessee." And we were both laughing. I said, "I'll see you in Tennessee, Buford." And I went out the door, and that's the last time I saw Buford. And then when I got to Tennessee to do the sequel, I met his daughter, Donna. And she told me about his death. I mean, it was passed off as a traffic accident, but she described it to me and told me how there was a skid marks and a tractor truck had came on. The tractor truck drivers were standing there looking at the car turned over and Buford lying under it. And Duana asked them to help her get him out from under the truck. And they went, "Not on your life, lady." And she crawled under the truck herself and dragged him out and held him in her lap, his head looking up at her. And he looked up and he just said, "Buona, Buona, run on. And he died.
Oh, wow.
And I had to get a paper bag because she was breathing heavily and let her breathe in and out because she was hyperventilating. And, of course, the truck was gone, and the accident was called an accident, and it wasn't an accident. It was an attempt to kill Buford, as he was always in danger. Whenever he'd arrive in a city, the local police, he was allowed to carry his own weapon, but the local police were always made aware that this was a man under threat. And I used to, you know, hang with you, Buford, when on set and off set. And one time I was having a lunch with he and a girlfriend that he had at the time, and I was looking at Buford, and I said, Buford, and he was wearing like tight clothing, and I said, Buford, aren't you supposed to be carrying a gun? I mean, where would you hide a gun? I can't see anything on you. And he reached over and poked at her purse. And he said, it's right in there. And I, you know, it always makes me laugh that this sweet little girl who was probably about 5 feet two, and Buford was, you know, a giant, of course.
And to explain, you heard of the Dixie Mafia, haven't you, Carl?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, the guys that Buford crossed were prototypes of the Dixie Mafia. It was from those guys that the Dixie Mafia really rose, and those were the ones who were after and had a Buford's number.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember, you know, reading the story, and you know, the movie comes out, and then the sequel is going to happen, and then Buford passes away in the accident, so. It was covered all over. I mean, I was up in, at that point, I was up in northwestern PA, and it was a big story. And, of course, that's because of how, you know, the movie beforehand and so on and so forth and the notoriety. So I was well aware of what was going on, at least at the time.
Yeah, well, you know, who knows who actually did it? I mean, there were so many people that were trying to do various illegal things in Tennessee and probably spread out the way beyond there. And but I remember Buford, just as a point of how Buford was about women. We were sitting at a table with one of the crash people, I think the sound guy, and his wife, and Buford and I at a table at the hotel restaurant. And some guy from another table who was obviously a little drunk was kind of staggering past our table, and he reached out to catch himself and put his hand on the shoulder of the lady, not meaning anything. And Buford saw that as an event, and he rose up and started to go after the guy, and the lady grabbed him and said, no, Buford, that's okay. Buford was not about to let any woman be in any way insulted. And so she saw that and grabbed him and held him, you know, in the spot. And Buford immediately calmed down because she calmed him down. I know Buford pretty well, and we had fun together. We made jokes. There's a picture of he and I making a joke about the club thing, about because it's a picture of me holding what was, we were joking about the club, and I was holding a pipe, and he reached down and pulled my gun out of my holster and was pointing it at me. So it was, you know, we joked at stuff, but Buford had a sense of playfulness too. One time he asked me if I would like a ride back to the hotel from the set, and I got in a car with him, and suddenly we're doing like 105 miles an hour down a country road with little farm roads popping in from either side, and I'm like, and Buford's looking at me, and he's obviously trying to scare the hell out of me, which he was, but I wasn't going to let him know. And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, Bruce. I don't seem to be able to get much speed out of this baby here. And I'm going to have it looked at." And I went, "Yeah, Buford, you better do that." So I survived that ride back to the hotel. And but I made sure I never got in a car that Buford was driving again unless there was a lady present.
I don't blame you.
He had a lot of, you know, he had a lot of special. But, you know, I did other films. You mentioned the Diamonds Are Forever
yeah.
film, and with Sean Connery and myself, and we had my wife was a ballet dancer, so when we were in, we met in New York and married in New York, and that's where Crispin was conceived and born. And but when film started to, television was killing off the theater, and it was getting less and less of opportunities to work in theater. So I really had to start switching to television and film. And but I was involved in theater, even off-Broadway, off-Broadway. I did one-year runs on Broadway. I did a Tennessee Williams play, Night of the Iguana. That was my first Broadway play.
Nice.
Tennessee was around. It ran for a whole year on Broadway. Tennessee was always around. He was a kindly old uncle or old aunt in a way. He was a sweet man, and God knows he was a great talent, and probably one of the greatest.
The only
playwrights.
Thing that really sticks out about your villainous role in Diamonds Forever is how you and the other guy had that kind of chemistry that's hard to really find or do with someone.
Well, it did, and it worked because the director, Guy Hamilton, who just passed about a year ago now, was a great director. And as I tell people, you know, if you have to study it, you're no good at it. If you're good at it, you can just do it. And that's the way I feel about acting. That's the way I was about acting. I never had a class. I never read a book on it. I just did it. And I started teaching other people to just do it instead of studying it. All of these schools of acting that are being pushed on people by massive groups of people who have never had a job in the business, telling them to do all of these techniques that will bury their instincts. And really talented people will survive bad teaching and somehow come out of it alive. I've been at it for a long time, but I just had instincts to do it correctly. I did get a degree. I have a Bachelor of Science in Speech from Northwestern University. Bachelor of Science means I can't stop talking. So, guys, you got to stay out of my way when I'm talking. It's just that's my Bachelor of Science in Speech stuff going on. I love talking to people that will listen. So thanks for listening. Thanks so much.
Oh, no problem at all, man.
Well, guests like you are the ones that we dream and pray about at night. Please let us get someone like you.
No.
Before you talk to you, Bruce, there's a movie that Carl wanted to ask you about. So go for it, Carl.
Okay, so there's actually a couple, but the first one I want to talk about a little bit is, I think it was your first film actually, and that would be Who Killed Teddy Bear. This one, Sal Mineo, and Jan Murray was in it as the lieutenant, and yeah, I think it was the first movie with Daniel Taranti's film debut also. And I just want to see what you remember of it. It's a film that's real interesting to me.
Okay.
That you had something like this that was someone on the sleazy side, and yet, you know, it's coming out in, what, 64, 65? 65.
It was,
and I just wanted to hear if you had any stories or anything about it.
Not a whole lot. You know, look, it was a job. I was an actor with a wife and a kid, and I needed to make money. So the opportunity to do this cop that I played in the thing was fine. You know, you get on the set, and they're just happy. You just come on and you do it. If you're doing fine, they never tell you anything. You know, and it's like they're too busy worrying about things that aren't fine. So, you know, everyone was a pro and was professional, and you get there. And movie sets can be very impersonal, especially maybe like 3 days of work for me. And that was fine. I paid several months' rent back in the days when New York was cheap to live in. So it was just a job. There's nothing particularly stunning about it. Look, I've done 100 films. That wasn't my first film. I already had done, I don't know, 5 or 6 films before that. I did some back when I was a college student.
He was uncredited in Frankenstein versus the Space Monster, which might be a good thing.
That was a lot of fun, actually. They put those Spock-like ears on me. And then they put a bald cap to make me look bald. And the other actor, who was the other space guy in it, he had a bald, he was bald, I was bald. And we had the ears, and I remember when they were taking our makeup off, they took my bald cap off, and they took his bald cap off, and he was bald underneath it. I said, what the hell did they ever bother? Why'd they bother putting a bald cap on a bald guy?
He had a little bit of hair left on his head, and he's like, I'll just shave it off. It's no problem. You don't have to put a bald cap on me. And they're like, no,
maybe.
Everyone else has bald caps. You got to have a bald cap.
I still run into that dude at the Academy now and then. I'm a member of the Academy since 1973 or 72, I guess, I've done Diamonds, I guess. That was a 6-month job. Diamonds Are Forever was a 6-month job, which was great. That was after a lot of other things here in L.A. Because once I made the move, I had come out for one visit to Los Angeles before I actually made the move. And the first visit was I had a Broadway show called Lion in Winter, and I was Robert Preston's understudy. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a part in the film, so I would be there with the director and the producer and the writers while they were criticizing the acting. I'd be watching the rehearsals, and they had just fired this girl and replaced her, and there was another terrific actor who I saw how terrific he was, and they were about to fire him, and I pulled him aside and started talking to him, and said, you know, a couple things, like every time you do this thing, come on over in the side lobby and we'll chat a little bit. And he went, oh, okay. He was very nervous, but I could see how talented he was. And it was Chris Walken, you know, who was, you know, after about a week of just simple talking to him, I didn't have to teach him how to act. He knew how to act. He just needed to stop worrying about what other people thought of his acting. That's the main problem for anyone that's good at something. If they start worrying to somebody else about how well they're doing, then they stop thinking of the things that they should be thinking of in order to do their art, whatever their art form is. You know, you can look at dancers who have great dance moves. I mean, technically they're great, but they're not that interesting because they're not listening to the music. They're not having an emotional experience. Dancers who have all the techniques may just have technique. Dancers may have technique and also have the heart, the soul of the music that makes them great. I did some dancing, too. I did an off-Broadway show for a year, and I did East Indian Kathakali dancing, where I had to learn to do It was a play by Rabindranath Tagore, the great Pulitzer Prize winning Indian writer, and it was called King of the Dark Chamber, and I played the evil king of Kanji, which was a lot of fun. I had a green face, and I'd sit in the dressing room, and I remember when we first got there, all the dancers, all the guys were put in one dressing room, and the only one who had his own dressing room was Brock Peters, and then Surya Kumari, the Indian movie star at that time, had her own dressing room, and I was stuck in a room full of all these guys who were all gay. And I'm trying to get in character, and it's like, and I said, can't you get me out of that? And they said, well, where would we put you? I said, put me in the girls' dressing room, and they did. And so I would just sit there, and I just put a little curtain down at one end where I could sit there, and the girls would seem to kind of like it that I was there. And I would put on my green face and my gold crown and my sword and a big skirt, and I had bare feet, and I had to do this. There's like seven different Indian classical dance styles, and I did Kathakali dance style, which is a lot of foot stomping and very strong moves and swords and things like that. So it was a great, great experience. But for a whole year, Brock Peters, who was a terrific friend of mine, had his own dressing room, and he was a terrific actor. He was a marvelous dude, too. And he and his wife became good friends.
Yeah, Brock is one of those guys from the 70s that never really did get his due or gets his due from any of the black film lovers of the 70s, isn't he, Carl?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I did a lot of those black films. I mean, Brock was a man of, you know, he was also a terrific singer. You know, he had a marvelous voice, and he didn't get into that, James Earl Jones. You know, he didn't get into the, you know, Black Gun. I did Black Gun and stuff like that with Jim Brown and where I was the bad guy, of course. And so that was the whole thing. But Brock was a man with lots of heart. He didn't do a lot of violent characters, which at one point, if you're going to be a star, you had to be a guy who kicked a lot of butt, like Jim Brown was.
The biggest play that I knew Brock was when he replaced John Amos on Good Times.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great, you know. But so theater was, you know, a marvelous experience because a lot of things that, well, I never thought I was going to be an actor. I mean, this is the way we used to talk in Chicago. If you were a tough guy in Chicago, you didn't talk about being an actor. It was like you talking about wearing a dress and lipstick, you know. So we were tough guys. So if you were a tough guy, you had to talk like this. So I was an athlete, and I was also an artist, and that's how I was getting. I had my first job when I was 5 years old. Well, six. I just turned six, and I used to deliver groceries, and I made 10 cents a day for 6 days' work. So I made 60 cents a week all day after, every day after school and Saturday mornings. And I was rich. But I never didn't have a job. I was a working class kid during the Depression era in Chicago. And at the age of eight, I was already jumping on a streetcar going down to the Loop in Chicago via the L trains. And worked on a newsstand in the Loop in Chicago, and from the time I was 8 to 13. And at 14, I worked in a glass factory, ladling hot glass. So to me, work is work, and you better enjoy it. No matter what it is you're doing, you have to enjoy that experience of dipping in and taking molten glass out of a thing and kind of swooping it up above to a giant machine, which was $250,000. They had a little 14-year-old kid feeding machine. But I was, you know, back in the, when I'm doing the newsstand, I made $6 a week. So my salary was zeroing up to the heights. And finally, working in the glass factory, I was making, if I did a full Saturday or half a day Saturday, I'd make $23 a week. So, you know, I mean, that's, what is that now, an hourly page, wage for somebody? I mean, I bet you guys make at least.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We make a lot, trust me. No freaking way.
Yeah.
So anyway.
We actually do this because we love doing it. And we love talking to people like you and hearing your stories, because we think it's important, you know, even just for historical sense, but just, you know, because we're interested. That's why we do it, and that's why we love doing it.
That's great. That's great. I mean, you know, you guys are fun, and to me it's fun.
And I'd love to be able to make $23 back then money.
Well, you
we'd kill for that, wouldn't we, Carl?
Hell, I'll take $23 today's money. I have no problem with that.
All right, I'll send it immediately. You just but you have to remember
what was
that
the other movie you wanted to ask about, Carl?
I tell you what, keep going, and I'll get there in a minute, okay?
All right. Lion in Winter with Robert Preston, and I looked at Chris Walken and saw, but I could see how talented he was, and he was a terrific actor and a terrific guy, by the way. Just a marvelous person. We became good friends, and so after a week of just, you know, giving him courage, he said, I guess I've got it now. And I said, I think you do, Chris. And he was nominated for Clarence Derwent Award for Best Newcomer of the Year on Broadway. And the play was going to be done, and New York was kind of done, but I had this part because I had done a previous play with the same director, and with Gene Simmons, if you remember Gene Simmons, a beautiful actress, not that guy who wears the weird makeup in that musical group. This is Gene.
I know who you mean. Absolutely. She's gorgeous.
She, gorgeous, beautiful lady, and very sweet. And I had a part in that play, and we were starting rehearsing in New York, and then we went to Pennsylvania. What's that city? Anyway, Philadelphia. So Philadelphia, and we were in a theater in Philadelphia, and the star of the movie was that Italian actor Ralph Bologna, and Bologna had been given he was noted as member of the Communist Party in Italy, and he was having trouble getting in. So I was his understudy, so I started rehearsing with beautiful Gene Simmons until Ralph could get into the country. And the first scene I had with Gene was a scene where I was playing a Spanish dictator, and I picked her up, and I kissed her. And go, I say to her, we go upstairs now. And so the director said, all right, let's rehearse it, and we rehearse it. And Gene thought it was kind of cute, and I thought it was beautiful, so we kissed. And the director, who was gay, was also a very good actor and a really super nice man, and he went, no, this is just a rehearsal, and we just totally ignored him and kept on kissing. And a few years ago, I remember an interview with like three star actors during Gene's big movie period, and they were all asked which of all the actresses they worked with had been the best kisser, And they had all nominated Jean Simmons, and boy, she's got my nomination too. She was a beautiful kisser and a beautiful lady. It was great fun to work with her. But then when Ruff finally arrived in the country, he was, we had been thinking, you know, he was a big Italian movie star, and we were all thinking, oh my God. And there was a terrific actor in the play named Larry Blyden. I remember a sweet, wonderful, talented guy who died way too early. That's one of the things about my age. I'm pretty old. I don't look my age, but you see so many people that you remember well and, you know, and sad that they go, but you have to survive it and keep on going. It's very important, but you have to find things to do. The only way you survive stuff is have something to do. Anyway, Ralph gets into the country, and he doesn't want to rehearse. He went, I'm watching him for a while. So he's watching me for a while. And then finally the director said, Ralph, you've got to start doing it. And the director pulled me aside and said, take Ralph aside and you coach him. So I ended up being the coach of this big Italian movie star. And Larry Blyden and I knew he was coming, and we had seen him in View from the Bridge, the terrific Arthur Miller play, which I had done earlier in Summer Stock. Summer Stock was a great place to learn how to act because you didn't have time to learn how. You just had to do it. Every 6 days you did a new play, and boom, boom, boom. You didn't have time to sit around and worry about it, whether you were good. You just had to do it. And again, what I say to people, if you can do it, do it. Stop worrying about it. Just do it. All the people that are listening to this, if you want to be an actor, don't wait and, you know, just find a way of doing it. Get into a play and do it. Get into a movie and do it. Just go somewhere and act. You can do it. Just be the person. Like, you know, when I said to Buford, all that stuff. You just look at stuff and let life in. If life is coming in, then art comes out. If life isn't coming in, fake art goes out. Real art comes from having an experience that causes you to have expressions of some sort that fires other people because you are having an experience that causes other people to have an experience of you, whether it's painting or writing or dancing or singing or playing the drums or acting. All of these things are things where you, you know, the person doing it has to be having your own personal experience. And if you don't let anything in, you can't have any experience. All of these bad schools of acting, including the method. And believe me, great people have come out of the method saying that they respect the method and they did it because of the method. They did it in spite of the method because they were talents and they survived it. There were other people that worked on the method for years and they just buried themselves because they were never going to get out of the pile-up of unnecessary techniques that they had to do. There's three or four other, you know, well-known teachers who teach that crap that causes you to be buried. Don't listen to it. I mean, I teach, but I teach people not to act. I teach people to just be real and live and experience, which is what I do as an actor, and it's why every character I do is an entirely different character. I'm not, it's never me on screen.
A former guest of the show and writer, Troy Howarth, he wanted me to ask you two questions. One, when you filmed the final scene in Chinatown, did you know after you shot it that the scene would become so iconic? And two, what was it like to work with Roman Polanski and everyone on the set of Chinatown?
Well, it was a great experience. Roman was one of those unusual directors, you know, like Guy Hamilton. You mentioned Guy Hamilton finding, you know, Putter Smith and me having this great rapport. Well, Guy Hamilton would go out there, and he was a a jazz musician fan, and he saw Putter Smith playing bass fiddle with Thelonious Monk. Guy was a Thelonious Monk fan. And he saw Putter Smith playing the bass, and he said to himself, that's one of the guys. Well, Roman had that same quality. My son Crispin has that quality. They hire people who nobody else would hire. They had an eye for something that was special. So Guy Hamilton for Putter Smith had something. He saw the putter had something. Now, what I had was somebody pushing me, a casting director who was very impressed by me. The business is very... People have to understand that if you want to make a living as an actor, you're going to have to be very smart about what you're doing. You have to know the difference between the art and the business. The business side of it is how do you promote yourself. And, just jumping back quickly, when you look at people that have challenge, the Actors Studio thing, a lot of people auditioned for the Actors Studio who got in, and then there were other people who auditioned for the Actors Studio who had to go back and back and back dozens of times before they could get accepted. It's absurd how many people were rejected by the Actors Studio and how many people were let in who were non-entities, great talents don't care about whether they're accepted or not. They just move on and actually work in the business. So,
Carl, how many people did you know from your New York days that had tried out for the Actors Studio and got rejected?
Me.
Not you personally. I mean, that you knew.
There are lots of people who got rejected by the Chris Walken got rejected by the Actors Studio 10 times before he was ever let in. Come on. I could see Chris Walken was a great talent even when he was about to be fired. But
yeah.
He went to the Actors Studio 10 times where he was given the membership. That's absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Strasberg was, he was not a good actor. So he was smart in a certain way. And I did an audition with a girl who was also working. And we were both working actors type, and we were given a callback. So the callback is when Strasberg makes the final decision. But there were a lot of people in the Actors Studio who called me, contacted me, said, we really want you to be in the Actors Studio, so be prepared for your callback with Strasberg. I went, okay, fine. But I was too busy trying to make a living supporting a wife and child.
Wow.
And the girl was too. And then finally they said, well, it's your last chance. You got to come in next week and do it. And so we went in and did it. And we got, we didn't get in. So I didn't care. That was fine. I was too busy working.
I mean, why should you care when you're working in, even if it's understudy in productions on the level of Night of the Iguana, The Lion in Winter?
Yeah.
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 So I do have a question, if I can butt in here, because I'm ready for this. And I'm going to say a little story. So I was in New York in the 80s. I ended up working for a woman who I'll give you her name in a second. And she was the head of Latino Playwrights down in Henry Street Settlement. She kept talking about this film she worked on. And when I was going through your filmography, I always tend to pick out the things that nobody else talks about. And there's a movie you did called Sweet Love Bitter, which was based on Charlie Parker. And you actually worked with this woman. Her name was Carla Pinson, and she was my boss. I was her administrative assistant. But also what really got me on this is, one, you were talking about jazz, and it's based on Charlie Parker, and also it's one of the few films that Dick Gregory did, and Dick is someone I have great respect for.
Yeah,
and I just wondered if you had any stories about that particular film.
Yeah, I do. Gregory was an innovative, great talent, and I mean, he was probably the first black stand-up comedian who was making an impact on the white audience, and he was
absolutely he was.
Yeah, and he was a transitioner. He was a transitional figure. So I was doing an off-Broadway play, and then I got this little gig in Philadelphia and got to do a scene in the thing, and it was just a small part. I was a cop of some sort who was going to arrest Dick Gregory or something. I kind of forget. You know, I did so many movies, and some of those were, thank God, here's it. But no, you know, I was a fan of Gregory back then, and so I had a black actor friend, and I said, "You know Dick?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Can you maybe? I would love to meet Dick Gregory before. I don't want to just meet him the first time in the set when I'm an officer arresting him." And he said, "Okay." And so he managed to get us into Gregory's hotel suite. And when we came in, he had like three big guys leaning against the wall, and Gregory pointed at me and he said, "You sit in that chair right there." And I went, "Okay." And the chair, there was sunlight shining in my eyes through the window, and I was kind of like, and he said, "No, just stay right there." He wanted the sunlight on my face. And I think it was a point of time where Gregory was probably being invaded by lots of people who were fans, you know, whites who were fans. And he had probably gotten a certain kind of thing where he was thinking that these people are just phonies. And so he was kind of interrogating me and wouldn't let me move out of this sunlight in my eye kind of thing. And then he was talking, and he said, and I was trying to get on a human. I said, "I've just had a son born. I'm now a new father, and I'm really excited about him, my beautiful wife, and I've just, you know, gotten him back from the hospital. He was born in New York." And Gregory said, "Well, I think anyone that goes to the hospital should just take any baby they give him." And I looked at him and I said, "Dick, you don't really believe that, do you?" I wasn't sure if the guys leaning against the wall were his sons or what. I said, "I know that you have family and you have sons and you can't tell me that you would have given up any one of your sons for anyone else's son. You wouldn't have given up one of your sons for my son, nor would I give up my son for anyone else's." And he went, oh. And suddenly he changed, and he waved at the guys. And he said, he waved them out. They all left the room. And then he said, "Oh, listen, hey, let me get you in a better chair over here." And then he put me out of the light, and then he sat. And then he entertained me and my black actor friend for a good hour, showing us clips and stuff like that. Obviously, it was a very interesting experience. I treasure the experience, and it made me understand things a lot. It always has. I mean, when I was a kid in Chicago, I used to have to make deliveries. My father had what he called a jewelry store, which was started out as a window in a barber shop. and eventually ended up with the barbershop being in the back of his jewelry. But he was really a watch repairer, so I would have to go make little trips. I was making trips picking up things for himself when I was like 8 years old. And I remember having to go into an area and on South State Street, and I got on the car, and within a block, all the white people had left. It was only blacks heading south. And I was like this little white kid. And the kindest it got was they didn't look at me. But if they looked at me, and I was very aware of it, it made me understand a lot of things. They looked at me with total hatred. If I were alone with you, I'd kill you kind of look. And I remember the store that I had to go pick it up was all paper thing, and the guy opened the door carefully and gave me the things that I had to bring back to my father. And I got up back on a streetcar heading north again. And again, the streetcar, the same angry-looking faces looking at me or kindly not looking at me at all. And I saw that the motorman up ahead had, I could see his white neck, and I went, oh, I just to feel comfortable. I rushed all the way up there, as we did on, Ed, when you were kids, like next to the motorman looking out the front. And I got up there and got to the spot next to the motorman. I looked up at him and with a big smile, and he turned and looked at me, and he was a mulatto with the same black features, and he looked at me with the same hatred that everyone else had been looking at me. And I always understood the sense of this, you know, the difficulty that these people were put in. I remember the first black person I ever saw. My mother had gotten me out of a streetcar. I was a little tiny kid, and I remember seeing a black man standing on the corner who was drunk. And I ran to him. I said, "Oh, look, mommy, black man. That's a black man." And I ran to him. I didn't know. I just noticed that he was black, and he was very sweet. And he looked down, and he was like taking my hand. And my mother was very nervous. And I got to know, in a sense, this guy for years. He used to deliver coal in our neighborhood. And strangely enough, I, at the age of, like, I don't know, 10, 12, I used to deliver coal. I had the same job that that guy had. I understood so much from being in various situations until, you know, one of the great things about sports is if you're on a football team, and if you're on anything, and people are more and more understanding of this, it doesn't matter if you're black or white. It just matters the work you're doing together. And if you're doing work with somebody that is doing good work and you're collaborating with each other, you forget that that person is black. You know, Felton Perry and I doing the first Walking Tall together film, you know, he was the black deputy from Chicago. He was from Chicago. I was from Chicago. And we used to play chess together constantly. In fact, I used to play chess with Roman Polanski in Chinatown, too. Chess was a great way of, you know, getting to know somebody. But Felton Perry and I would be sitting on the side of the pool in Jackson, Tennessee, and there'd be these white, redneck guys playing grab-ass with each other who were, you know, probably Tennessee salesman-type guys and hating the fact there was a white guy and a black guy playing chess together on the side of the pool. So, you know, I just remember so much of these things and the understanding. So when Gregory did that thing with me, I knew what he was doing, and I understood his situation. And then
another thing about that time period with him, which is 67, he was definitely being followed by the FBI. There was a folder out on him and that sort of thing. You know, he was a bit paranoid, and for good reason.
He might have thought I was FBI.
Well, Carl, wasn't about every comic that wasn't your straight white Borscht Belt guy scared crapless after Lenny Brute? What happened to Lenny?
Yeah.
Well, there's that, and also the idea with particularly Gregory, and with his book that he wrote too, which I'm going to say the word, so forgive me, but the title of his book is Nigger, and he.
I just say the N word is an ugly word, and it's been used to hurt a lot of people. So
absolutely, but in a case like this. This is the name of the book, and there's a reason for that.
Right.
And Dick talks about how being this comic that is crossing over to the white audience, how that was very, very confrontational for everyone involved. And
put his career on the line. He probably could have slid through for years. Just, you know, getting riches and stuff, it hurt him probably financially to get out there and become political, which is another bravery on his part that he put in he put at risk his career.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing, when he passed away last year, we did a show, and Dick Gregory has always been one of my big heroes because, you know, people talk about Richard Pryor. People talk about Lenny. You know, in many, many ways, he did the same thing, and it was just as brave, and just as out there. And that type of courage we don't see
right
today.
Well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You're seeing women coming up and being courageous. You know, the Me Too movement, which can, you know, become overbalanced in any direction, but certainly there is a point where things get too much attention just because they have that, you know, something to do with racism or female, you know, abuse. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the best thing. It just means that it gets more attention than it artistically deserves. There are things that it should, you know, things are not always being judged on how good they are. I mean, when Gregory was doing humor, there was no judgment. It had nothing to do with, you know, getting extra attention because he was black. It was him being able to break through and grab the attention of the white audience. And
exactly.
Now, there is
I seen this list, and it was about 3 weeks ago. I think I showed you, Carl, and it had Us as one of the most important black horror films that you need to see. So the movie came out. I'll be okay with it, but it came out. Was it like 1 or 2 weeks before the movie came out? And then
it was two weeks.
Almost no one had seen it yet.
What was it called?
Us. And they were calling it one of the most important black horror films out there. And the movie hadn't even came out yet. Carl, was it like 2 weeks before the movie came out? I showed you that list.
I think it was 2 weeks. I think it was 2 weeks, Steve.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Well, I didn't like the film, frankly. I thought it didn't do service to the way it portrayed blacks in general. The one good character in it was a guy who was a sheriff, and he was black, and he made blacks look like the way you would admire a person to be. They had these other people looking robotic, and it wasn't, you know, I mean, the guy who was being brought to meet the white family, again, you know, he was a decent actor and an attractive person. But the evil of somehow this story of this woman bringing this guy down to meet her family because she went out of her way to have a relationship with a black person in order to bring him down to torture him was, to me, it's just, I'm sorry, that's a little sick. The idea that, there are incredibly stupid, cruel, racist people. But that story bothered me. I didn't like it, and I didn't like particularly the way the film was done. And again, there's too much attention being paid and given adulation to something that I thought was a mediocre piece of artwork. I don't think it was good. And in spite of the fact there were talented people in the film. So, again, that's part of what I was saying, that sometimes there are mediocrities being forgiven and being said that they were great just because of the racial or the sexual kind of thing. I mean, do we have to be anti-gay if we show a gay person, or do we have to, like, you know, the character that I played in Diamonds Are Forever and Putter and I, this was the first time in films that two characters in a film were being actually identified as gay. I mean, there were obviously actors that seemingly were gay in films that you would watch and kind of realize. My wife was a ballet dancer, so we had gay friends around all the time in New York. She was also a Broadway dancer. And they'd be like, oh, if you two get divorced, I don't know which one I'm going to marry, you know. And I used to laugh. I had fun with these people. And they were talented, nice people, and, you know, it was great to be around and all that stuff. But when
but the gay angle in Diamonds Are Forever paid off because of which one of you survived to attack him in the final scene was trying to kill him, not because they're bad guys, but because he killed the lover.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but we had tried to kill Connery several times before that. But the point is, I knew what how to make it funny. And I didn't, you know, a lot of the ideas in the film, Guy Hamilton would just say, I would say, Guy, how about such and such? He said, all right, show me. And I would show him, and then he'd call over the Aussie DP, and he would always go, yep. And so every idea I had, and all the big laughs in the film are my ideas. Certainly the final moment when Sean does the rude thing with the thing giving me a friendly up the yoo-hoo with his ha-ha, and
sorry, I had to laugh at that.
And, you know, and then my character having the last great sexual moment of his life before being exploded was funny, and not because I was, you know, I was very careful not to do a gay kind of accent or a gay kind of thing. So when I actually got the role, I'd never read for it. It was just a series of promotions by a casting director and a couple of projects that I was in that made them think they should hire me. But again, Guy Hamilton took on Putter Smith, who had never acted before. And the last meeting I had was with the two producers, Guy Hamilton and casting director. And they're looking at us being interviewed, and there were three guys showing up. And there was Putter Smith, me, and another guy was kind of like a Putter Smith type in a way, but he was an actor I knew a little bit and knew he was talented. Putter was like shy and kind of grumpy, and I didn't think much of Putter at that meeting. So I started promoting to the producers how great an actor this other guy was that was there. And I figured, as soon as I saw those two guys together, I thought, oh, my God, this means I've got the part. These two guys are auditioning to see which one of those two guys is going to be with me. So I started promoting this other guy. And then I realized later that Putter Smith was the guy who had the part, and I was auditioning against this guy that I was telling him how great an actor he was. So Guy Hamilton had chosen Putter Smith because he saw a quality in him. Great directors. Guy Hamilton had that. Roman Polanski had it in Diamonds Are Forever. He cast people that he had never, you know, had never acted before in that thing. Crispin, my son Crispin Glover, has cast people that had never acted before. And he made people like that, put people in situations that make them great. You know, if you look at, you know, great directors can put unusual people, and what they get out of them is they get the reality of that person. So Potter Smith and I got together, and we were good because I liked Potter, and Potter was fun, and I would have a lot of fun with Potter. But I knew the point of view of the gay person. And I knew what would be funny and what wouldn't be funny. So the laughs that I got were based on my idea of knowing how that audience would react to it. There was a scene where after we'd just blown up, I put a scorpion down a guy's... Actually, we shot the thing two ways. One time, I had a live scorpion. I still have it. It lives in my bathroom upstairs. We're still pals. I call him Scorpy. Scorpion, I would put down the guy's throat at one point. And I think we used a rubber one for that one. And then we also shot it with me putting it down his back and the guy dying. And then a helicopter, we blow up a helicopter. And as we are walking away from the scene of our crimes into the desert sky, I reach over and take his hand and we walk off holding hands. When we did it, I like to make jokes on sets, when the director said, "Okay, print it, that's done, cut," and I yelled out, "You're blushing," and which he probably was blushing, and made the crew laugh. So I like to make jokes on sets, so I made that joke, and so when Putter and I were, we went all the way through the film, but I knew what would get a laugh because I have a good sense for comedy because I did a lot of theater where you do a play every week, and I did 20-week seasons. So in a 20-week season, you did almost 20 plays. You might have one play that ran twice or one play that was 2 weeks long or like a musical or something like that. But you didn't have, you know, you just went ahead and did stuff, which is what I kind of teach people to stop being taught, you know, just do it, do what you're going to do. Anyway, so when they were going to show the film on television, it was at least 5 years later, that scene where Putter and I reach out and grab each other's hand and walk off holding hands was cut from the showing on television. It was outrageous.
Bullshit.
They wouldn't show it. So, you know, times do change. And it's a constant education. So right now I do think we're in a phase where, you know, racism has caused a over adulation of films that maybe don't deserve quite the credit. But if you want to look at terrific film, there are films that have black qualities to them that are great films. But there have been great black actors for years that were around for years that were doing great film, and they were just accepted as another person. So if you're playing football, everybody on your team, you're just on a team together. So you're not, and you're enjoying, you know, your relationship, and you reach a point where you're not, you know, when I see Felton Perry, I haven't seen him recently because he doesn't come to the Academy anymore, but we used to play chess and all that stuff. Whenever I see him, I don't think of him as a black guy. I mean, I know he's black. He knows I'm white. But we don't think of each other that way. We're just pals. We're friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Buddies. And guys
like, who, Carl, the year Get Out come out, another film came out that you love to death, right?
You got to remind me. My mind is a little bit fuzzy, to say the least.
Well, I'm sorry to bother you.
Tell me, what film are you talking about?
Sorry to Bother You.
Was it C.C. Ryder?
No, this one was
satire. It's a black telemarketer, and it's a satire on consumerism and capitalism, and done by a musician by the name of Boots Riley, and it's something. If you haven't seen it, I would recommend it. I love the movie.
Danny Glover, he has to get his white voice to get his man to try to sell to white America.
One film that I there's a movie that I really was the kind of race movie that dealt with. It's called Hidden Figures, and it was a year before Alaska.
Yeah.
And Hidden Figures was a brilliant film, brilliantly done, and really showed an amazing piece of historical truth about these women who, of course, they rose through the lack of fairness and got themselves educated, and their qualities and intelligences came out, and they were able to have a heavy impact on the rocket science of this country. And it's a beautiful film, and it's a film that's one I recommend looking at, because it doesn't deal with, oh, I don't know, just a bunch of noise and bang-bang and stuff like that. It deals with how people are. I mean, there have always been people who rose through. Look, I rose through being a poor kid who didn't have, you know, that had to work when I was 6 years old. And because the talent was there, and I did the hard work. I worked my way through college. Now, here's an unusual piece of history that not too many people know, but I was playing football. I was on we were city champs in Chicago in 1949, high school city, all city champs. We played in Soldier Field in front of, you know, 200,000 people, and great experience. And we won. And I was given football scholarships. I played but for certain reasons, I played at a junior college in Chicago football for 2 years. I was all conference both years. And on Sunday, I would play for a semi-pro team under another name. So I was a real athlete. I'm not a giant of a guy, but I'm very strong and always have been a workout person. So a buddy of mine and I, who used to work out with weights together and do art projects with, he was going to the Art Institute in Chicago. And he said, "Bruce, you got a good build on you. You ought to go down there and pose at the art class for the art classes." And and I went, "Yeah, okay." And I was posing at the Art Institute in Chicago because, you know, here was this weird thing, this combination of the art thing with John and I, who were doing art projects with, who talked with the D's, Dems, and Doe's thing. And I'm posing, there was a beautiful naked woman posing across the room. And she came up to me at the break and said, "Bruce, how would you like to..." And she paused and kind of rolled her eyes a little bit. And I thought, what the hell is she going to ask me? I mean, I'm a guy, and I'd seen her naked, and my mind was going, like to, and... And suddenly she said, "Be a gorilla." You know, what the hell is she talking about? And it turned out she was a stripper. She needed a guy strong enough to wear a 100-pound ape suit and toss her around in a strip act. And I thought, well, that sounds like a very dignified thing to do. And so the guy who owned the act in Chicago, he was like an agent for strippers. And there were lots of strip clubs in those days. And he said, "Go down to the Lincoln Park Zoo and meet Bushman." Well, Bushman was a very famous Chicago Lincoln Park Zoo gorilla. He weighed 500 pounds. And so I went down to meet Bushman. And when I was looking at him in the ape house, he looked over at me. And he raised his hand and kind of gestured at me to come over to him. And I did. And then he looked at me. And he said, "Bruce, first, don't tell anyone I can talk." I went, "Okay, Bushman." And he said, "Now, think my thoughts." I went, "Okay." He said, "Do my moves." I went, "Okay." So that's to me. And then he said, "Now get out of here. That's the end of your first acting lesson." So that's what I did in the eighth act. We went down to Florida, Tampa Bay, Florida, and had like an eight-week gig there, and I'm in the ape suit. And in those days, strip clubs were kind of classier. Strippers were classier. They didn't do lap dancing. They had a certain kind of high-minded kind of dignity to them. And there would be stand-ups, as there probably still are. And there was a magician working in this club in Tampa Bay, Florida. And he came over to me one day and in front of, you know, other people, and he took his magic wand and he tapped me with it on the shoulder and on the chest and on the other shoulder and then on the top of the head. And he said, "You are an actor." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You'd make that gorilla so believable if you ought to try acting." So that was the first time anyone told me I was an actor. And there was a guy working in the nightclub who was a singer in the club who was from New York. He said, "Yeah, you ought to go to acting classes in New York." And I went, "Acting classes? There are classes?" And he said, "Yeah." And I went, "Oh." Well, I still don't believe in acting classes. I believe in non-acting classes. And that's what I teach. So I got drafted for the Korean War. I had 2 years of football at the junior college, but I flunked English. And the reason why I flunked English was kind of a weird thing nobody knew about. And that got me drafted, and I got to Korea for the last 6 months of that war and survived it and came back. And but I came back with malaria, and I couldn't pick up a football scholarship that was offered to Colorado College. And so I was walking around the school where I played football, and, you know, picking up a few more college credits, and I noticed a play being advertised, and it was a Tennessee Williams play called Camino Real. And I auditioned for it, and the director teacher at the school said, "Come back for the callbacks." And I didn't go back. I guess maybe there was something in there. I thought, well, that magician said I was an actor, and I auditioned, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I didn't want to go back. It was kind of freaked out by the whole thing. And then I'm walking down a flight of stairs at the college, and this teacher comes rushing up the stairs. I said, "Where were you?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You didn't come back to the callbacks." I said, "I know, I'm a little busy. I'm setting up stuff. I've got other things to do." And he said, "I want you to play the lead." I went, "Oh, okay."
Oh.
And I did, and I was good, and, you know, and I got good reviews, and I went up, and I did a couple community theater things around there where the actors were all trying to be more Hollywood than Hollywood could possibly be, but, and I did a Wagnerian opera because I can also sing, and I went to a summer stock company up in Wisconsin lived out of my car, slept on the porch of the theater because I couldn't afford to live inside, starved all that summer, got the lead every week. And then I decided, this is it. Hell with football. I'm going to be an actor. So that was the change for me. And I did go to Northwestern, and the best thing they did at Northwestern was make me do Shakespeare. So I had to lose my D's, Dims, and Do's accent. So I didn't talk like that anymore. When you're doing speak the speech, I pray is I pronounce it to you.
Actually, to do Shakespeare with that accent would be rather interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do it. Okay, you guys put it on. I'll be down there.
But, yeah, me and Carl talked about this on the show that we did on character actors. How we love you guys because we get you when you do it. Like, no acting school, no fancy flourishes. All right, Carl?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things about character actors I've always liked is that from film to film, you know, it's the same actor, but it's a different character, and you don't make that connection, you know, because you're so different. And certainly of the material I know of yours, that's very true.
It is true of me. It's not true of other actors. There are other people that are called character actors. They're the same character every time they work. There are stars that are that way. A lot of stars are mostly themselves constantly. But Ben has the ability to go in different directions. So does Chris Walken, Warren Beatty was a friend of mine in college who I told to leave school and go to New York. But Chris Walken had that ability until they kind of typed him into doing imitations of himself after a while. But Chris was able to do a variety of things. It doesn't mean you're a bad actor if you're the same every time you work. I think there's a certain, for me, sometimes the term character actor can be misunderstanding and making it feel like, okay, you're kind of some small part player. Well, actually, every role should be a character. But there are great actors who do great work, and they're always themselves, and they're still doing great acting because they put themselves in the situation of the character, but it's them in that situation. Mm-hmm. With oddballs like me, I am not, that's not me. That's the character I've created. I do have a minor in psychology, so a lot of my approach to teaching has to do with what's going on with you. What's working? What's not working? What do you want to achieve? Why aren't you achieving it? What do you achieve and you don't even know you're achieving it? It's a matter of examination of the realities of anything. And to be a good actor doesn't necessarily mean that you become a different character. There are a few people... Dustin Hoffman was capable of doing different characters. I mean, now mm-hmm. he's just Dustin Hoffman all the time. But here was another guy. I was his understudy in an off-Broadway play that was at a theater of a cousin of Tennessee Williams, and I was his, Dustin Hoffman's, understudy in a play that off-Broadway in New York. When I saw Dustin was, I could see how talented he was. You know, I mean, he's a different kind of person than Chris Walken, but you know, you could see how talented he was. But he had to audition for the Actors Studio 10 times before they let him in. What the hell was Strasberg not able to see right away that these people were great talents? You know, it's truly strange. But, you know, power, and, you know, suddenly you're given this power is okay. I have nothing against Strasberg. He was doing the best he could with the abilities that he had, and he'd been suddenly given this gig as being the head of the Actors Studio because what's his name, the great director who directed Brando and Streetcar and
Elliot Kazan. Elliot Kazan.
Yeah,
was supposed to be the head of the Actors Studio, but he was too busy having a career. Strasberg never had a career. He was, you saw him act a few times, and he was not a good actor. He was okay. Making sure he didn't make a mistake, which that's one of the main problems.
That goes into the old argument about theory and practice.
You know, it
seems
Strasberg
was well versed in acting theory.
Yeah. But the theory was one he made up, and he distorted a lot of Stanislavski. Stanislavski was never finished learning. He was constantly an explorative person, and he did great work as a director with people. I saw a play that he directed, and I could see the kind of work that he was capable of doing. I mean, at Northwestern University, certainly I read Stanislavski and Boleslavski, both of whom were people of humor and a constant approach to growth. These other people who have done these slam, dang, bang, bump, this is the truth, people are idiots. Again, as I said earlier, that 60 years plus, really more than that, of working around the business. I started in my ape act when I was in 53. By the way, I worked my way through college in that ape suit. I'd be doing Shakespeare all day long, and then at midnight I'd be in my ape suit tossing around a naked girl.
I'm okay with that job. I'm okay with that job.
Me too.
I'll take it. No problem.
Well,
you'd have to gain at least 100 pounds in muscle.
You know what? Naked girl, it's worth it. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, me too.
Especially if they paid in cheese, then you'd be there no matter how skinny you are.
This is true. I'm addicted to cheese, Bruce. Don't worry about it.
I got to know a lot of women that were, working around there. And, I knew people that were in the sex industry. I mean, I watched a lecture of a $100 a night call woman teaching other people how to do, begin a self-abortion with a knitting needle so that they could get to the hospital and get aborted when they were pregnant. And these were trying to survive, They were prostitutes, and they were prostitutes of a variety of personalities. Some were smart, some were sadly stupid, some were addicted. They're people. And I have a sense of, hey, everyone's a people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Try to do with it what you can and whatever advantages you have. I mean, if you happen to be gorgeous like me, thank you. And I'm so humble about that. I didn't know I was that good looking when I was starting out. Now I know how good looking I was. I wish I'd have taken more advantage of it.
We all say that once we get old, don't we, Carl?
I say it every day. What can I tell you?
Yeah, lots of pats on the back for all of us. Well, anyway, guys, we've been at it for an hour and a half now. Where do you want to go now? Or do you just want to say bye-bye, Brucey? Love to...
Yeah, let's just wrap it up.
Thank you for being on
and all your stories and for definitely all your work throughout the years. You are one of those guys, if you've seen your name on the list of the movie or the box list, it would be like, oh, at least we're going to get one great performance out of this movie, guaranteed.
Thank you.
Yeah, I talk about character actors, and those actors that really inhabit a character and are chameleons. And that, my friend, is you.
Thank you,
my question.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. Well, it's been a terrific experience. Sometime in the future, if you're totally bored and you can't find anyone else, call me back again and we'll do it again.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, if you had a good time, you could always let your son know that we'd love to have him on, too.
Well, he's busy all over the place right now. He's got that series, American Gods, and then he's working editing.
Yeah.
He's touring his other two movies, one of which I'm in, You know, What Is It is an amazing movie about Down syndrome people. And then there is It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine, and I have a part in that, and it is an amazing film. But, you know, and if you go to any of his shows, he does what's called the Crispin Glover Big Slide Show, and he does narrations and improvisations in front of the screen while they show pages from these books that he's edited. And he's an amazing talent, and he does these amazing things. So if you have the chance to see him, I know he's going to end up in Chattanooga doing one of his movies, and he's in, I think he's in Phoenix right now, and then he might be going, he's going to, I forget where. Anyways, look at it, just look up Crispin Glover, Hellion Glover, area where you can find out.
What I love about Crispin is he's one of those guys who isn't happy unless he has three or four things going on at once.
He's like me. He has three or four things going at once, and that's the way I am. I have to have stuff going on. I mean, if I'm not doing stuff, I'll go crazy. I mean,
right.
Crispin's mother was a terrific woman, and we lost her almost 3 years ago now, and I miss her every day. My wife, Betty, and a myriad number of names, was a terrific dancer, terrific actress. She could write. She did the stock market. She did all kinds of marvelous things, and we lost her. And I personally feel I've lost her every day, but the gift of having been with her for 56 years, and now it's almost 59 years, even after passing, is a gift. And the gift of having been with somebody that long, I mean, some of you people who are in relationships should not be mad enough to break it today. Kind of live through that moment when you want to kill that other person, you know, because there isn't anyone more annoying to live with than the person you're living with, but that includes you. So so try to get through that day.
Saying a word. I won't get a comment.
But, you know, life is a gift. Try to live it every day. I do. It doesn't mean that every day is perfect. Every day is what you have to live through. So if you look at, like, the people in Forgotten, you know, it is a process of, you know, take the gift of it and give a little gift back. Right now I'm worried about our environment. People should be aware that bees are dying because of stupid things being done by the Bayer company, where they put things out there that are killing off bees. And if they kill off the bees, eventually we will have no vegetation. So if any of you, butterflies, you know, if any of you have a place where you can start a beehive, do it. But politic about the Bayer company doing these terrible things that are killing off bees, that they put on crops so that people can grow a bunch of junk that's not good for you anyway. And killing off the bee population is the end of us all. You know, I mean, we've got to stop with the pollution of the planet. We need to save the earth, for not just for ourselves, even for us long livers, but for those of us who are, you know, looking ahead to having children and grandchildren. Give them a break. One of the great things about women getting more powerful is they're taking more control of how many babies they're going to have. We're not just going to overpopulate by just making every girl we see pregnant 12 times.
That's what Carl tried to do in New York back in the day, but no women would be willing to take it.
True. True.
Different than is, Bruce, I knew I was ugly back then. Carl didn't.
Well, just pretend like you're gorgeous and be the gorgeous person you are inside.
No, thank you so much, because I do pretend that a lot.
And with that, goodbye, everybody. everybody, and have a good rest of your day, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. And thank you to Carl and Bruce for being on. Goodbye,
thank you, Bruce.
Everybody.
It was a pleasure, man. Good night.
Nighty-night.